science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now I'm joined by Ellen Blackman, AUT chemistry professor. Sorry, Ellen, just like straight from one life thing to another. We're just getting straight into it because we've got a very packed show today.
It's all happening.
So the first story that we're talking about today is about a new shared science centre called Open Sesame, which is set to open in the Middle East. This is a very exciting project.
It is a really, really cool project, actually. I was really pleased to see this in the news. What this sesame thing is a synchrotron, and possibly your listeners, might not be familiar with what a synchrotron is. Mm. So by way of introducing this, imagine if you put a 15-watt light bulb in your front room and turned it on, you would sort of see everything in your room, but it wouldn't be particularly distinct or anything like that. And then you go and put a 100-watt light bulb in, and then you can see everything much more clearly. Everything's a lot more distinctive. You can see the fine detail, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what essentially a synchrotron does. So its purpose is to generate light, in inverted commas. And by light, we mean radiation ranging from the infrared and the visible and the ultraviolet and X-rays. And in chemistry and physics in particular, we use light to study the structure of materials. So we can get the structure of molecules down to dimensions of 10 to the minus 12 meters, you know, absolutely tiny. So we're talking molecular scale here. And in order to do that, we need very bright light, okay? Be it infrared or visible or ultraviolet or X-rays. Mm. And synchrotrons are the best way of generating this really, really, really bright light that we can use to study everything. And they don't come cheap, so they cost around about a couple of hundred million. That's in Aussie dollars, that's what the one in Australia costs. So there's about 60-odd synchrotrons around the world. Closest one to us is in Australia. And so last week, this new synchrotron in Jordan was opened, and that might be no great shakes to everyone listening, but the important thing is that this is a collaborative project between countries such as Israel, the Palestinian Authority, Jordan, Iran, Cyprus, Turkey. Okay, so
a lot of places that haven't historically had the happiest sort of political dialogue.
Indeed, yes, yes. So politics seem to go out the window in this case, and
that's really awesome.
I think it's absolutely fantastic. So we're going to get scientists from Iran and Israel collaborating. We're going to get scientists from Cyprus and Turkey collaborating, and this is absolutely wonderful. And this will be a real asset to the scientists in that part of the world. It's the first synchrotron to open in the Middle East, and it's going to do remarkable things. So, you know, that's a feel good story, I guess.
Yeah, it's always good to have those on the wire. We often don't, so you know.
Well, we've got Médecins Sans Frontières. You could perhaps call these Scientifiques Sans Frontières, perhaps. But if we wanted to be a little bit yes. So I think that is a really, really wonderful story, and it'll be interesting to see how that transpires. But as I said, it was opened last week. Funding for it comes from those particular countries, plus they're also getting helpful funding from the EU, I believe, as well. So they're also putting money into it because, as I said, it's not a cheap thing. And the upkeep also to keep it running is substantial. So we're millions of dollars a year sort of thing.
Mm. So from what I understand, this idea of a Middle Eastern synchrotron has been on the table for decades now, but now it's actually come into fruition.
Yes.
So what's shifted?
That's a really good question, because a few years ago Israel supposedly assassinated a couple of Iranian scientists who were part of this project. So, you know, something massive must have happened since then.
I know. Cooperatively.
But, you know, they're obviously letting bygones be bygones in the name of science, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And if the rest of the world could follow suit, then, you know.
Absolutely. Mm. And so what are the impacts of this for the future of scientific research in the Middle East?
It can't help but help. That's basically it. This is state-of-the-art machinery. And generally you only find state-of-the-art machinery in sort of, dare I say it, your first world countries, you know, your Europes and your Americas and et cetera, et cetera. And I think to see this in this part of the world is just, you know, really, really wonderful. There are a lot of fantastic scientists in that part of the world, and whose science is limited by basically the equipment that they have got. Mm. Now they've got access to this, you know, the world is their oyster.
And maybe they would have had to potentially go overseas further their career, whereas now is more opportunity for them to stay in the Middle East, so kind of combating that brain drain.
Yes, yep, absolutely. And when you are using these machines, like a lot of New Zealanders use the Australian machine, you can book time on it for about a year in advance, and they might give you a day or something, and you're up 24/7 on that day. You don't sleep, you don't eat, you don't do anything, you just do your stuff. So, you know, time on these things is very, very highly prized. So I think it's great.
Cool.
Really nice.
And so our next story today that we're looking at is a New Zealand-related one. So New Zealand's Alpine Fault has been found by researchers to have extremely hot temperatures and high fluid pressures. Mm-hmm. So what does this mean? Talk me through.
Well, I think the geologists are still trying to figure out exactly what it means, which is, I guess, part of the thing. But last week there was a paper in Nature published about this, which is fantastic. Whenever New Zealand gets a paper in Nature, I think that's a wonderful thing. So this is a joint project, about 100 scientists from 12 countries, and what they did was to go to the Alpine Fault and drill two holes into there, and they got roughly around about a kilometre deep into the Alpine Fault. And as you said, what they found, the main finding of this, was that temperatures were remarkably hot in the Alpine Fault, and the pressures, the water pressures underneath, were also very, very high as well. So the Alpine Fault runs up the Southern Alps, and it supposedly ruptures every 300 or so years, and it gives rise to roughly sort of a magnitude 8 earthquake. The last time it ruptured was 1717. So this is 300 years.
coming up to its next time.
Indeed. And so it's very, very unusual. The high temperatures and the pressures you normally see in areas that have got volcanism. So you'd expect that possibly more in the North Island than the South Island. South Island doesn't have any volcanoes. There's no volcanoes on the Alpine Fault. And so therefore that's quite surprising.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And so they are potentially, they're talking about using this as a potential geothermal power source,
which is
kind of interesting. They say that, you know, the temperatures and the pressures would lend themselves very, very easily to having a geothermal power station there, which will raise the ire of some, but it sounds like sounds like a good idea, I reckon. You know, it's good renewable clean energy. So, and the other thing about this is that normally, this is the first time it's been done on a fault that has yet to rupture, or hasn't ruptured for a long time. Generally, when people drill in faults, they're drilling them after an earthquake has happened. And this time, they're drilling it before an earthquake's happened. So that's what makes the novelty of this.
Right. So, and does that sort of have some significance for the international research community as well?
Yeah. Well, again, it's all adding to knowledge. And, you know, one day in the near future or the distant future, we'll be able to predict earthquakes. And this all goes to that. So this is, you know, a contribution to the font of knowledge about geological structures and potential earthquakes. Yeah.
So helping, so more knowledge to help model.
Yes. Yeah.
Future hazards.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, and as I said, it's a Nature paper, which is, you know, that's a real wonderful thing for New Zealand science. So
the one of the heavyweight journals.
It's the heavyweight journal. Everyone wants to get published in Nature. So yeah.
And lastly today, we're looking at a new study that suggests atheists are more intelligent because they can override religious instinct. I feel like this is a pretty big call when you sent me this story, Alan. Not going to lie.
Well, so it actually surprised me too. So apparently the fact, and it is a fact, that there is a negative correlation between religiosity and intelligence was first studied in, or first proposed anyway, 1924, which surprised me. And ever since then, there's been about 60-odd studies replicating these results. And I had no idea this existed. And apparently, the more fundamentalist you are, the lower your intelligence is, apparently.
But, like, on average, though, you know, this is a correlation thing. Let's be clear.
It's just a trend. It's a correlation. It doesn't say anything about individual particular people. But there is this particular negative correlation. And so these researchers in England and in the Netherlands, they did this meta-analysis of all of these studies and then came up with the idea to explain the observed results that religion is an instinct. So, you know, sort of this inbred thing that we are supposedly born with.
Mm.
And that intelligent people are able to override their instincts. And particularly in times of stress and stuff like that, where you just, you know, operate by instinct, people who have higher intelligence can sort of step back, override their instincts, and then pick the sensible thing to do. And so this is their explanation, I guess, of these data. Now, this is psychology, and you know, what I don't get about psychology, there's been 63 studies of this correlation. Why the need for 63 studies? You know, if you do it once or twice or something like that, you've pretty much nailed it, haven't you?
Yeah.
Jeez, where do they get the funding to do 63 different studies on the same bloody thing? If we did that in chemistry, we'd be laughed out of court. But, you know, psychologists are different. And again, you know, this is just a proposal. It's not God's revealed truth or anything like that, but this is their explanation of these particular data. So they're saying that religion is an instinct. It's something that we're born with, which leads to all sorts of questions its own right, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm really curious what made them choose to treat religion as an instinct.
Good question. Very, very, very good question. But
it's like, isn't religion like a worldview just as, you know, atheism as? So why does, I don't know.
And now you're getting into the philosophy of things. And then, their point was that if it is an instinct and you know, since the dawn of sort of modern, quote unquote, man, sort of 11,000 years ago, you know, our way of life has changed. We've gone from being hunter-gatherers to, you know, sit on the couch and look at TV is sort
whatever
of thing.
Whatever we are.
Yeah. And so what was a good instinct back in those days might not necessarily be good for us these days. And so that was sort of their point, that the ability to override that instinct is a trait of intelligence or a mark of intelligence or whatever. And they made an interesting point that in 1998 they did a survey and they found that 3.3% of members of the Royal Society believed in God. And I've got to say, I'm very surprised it was that low. I do have a few scientist friends who are religious, and I can't quite get around that fact, but, you know, to each their own, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, isn't it something that you could perhaps compartmentalise as well, that, you know, your faith shouldn't really intrude on trying to find robust data from research? I don't know.
No, it shouldn't. Oh, you're absolutely right. But I just find it very difficult to reconcile the two, because they do kind of tend to be, to me, anyway, mutually exclusive.
Right.
But, you know, saying that, you're going to get hundreds of calls after this. You know,
yeah. I mean,
as you do every week.
I know what you mean, in the way that as a researcher you have to be open to the uncertain and not have any sorts of things.
Oh, yes, of course.
Having a faith, you maybe might have more ideas of certainty than somebody who doesn't.
I think that's a fair point. Yes. Mm. Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
So maybe that's the sort of conclusion that we can come to with, hopefully not offending anybody. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us again, Alan.
We'll not a see problem,
Shemina. Great to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
We'll see you again next week.
Cool, will do.
That was Dear Science.
Your Honour, all I'm guilty of is hunger.
Yet you're at Love Bucket, drinking handcrafted cocktails on tap.
I just couldn't fight my urges, Your Honour.
Then I sentence you to a collaborative concoction of comfort foods, bursting with Asian flavours and a pinch of playfulness.
What?
Thursday to Saturday evenings this month, Judge Bao hijacks the Love Bucket kitchen for a three-week residency. Sentence your taste buds to delicious modern Chinese with expert drink matching by the amazing Love Bucket team. The Judge Bao pop-up kitchen at Love Bucket, only at 309 K Road. You love music, right?
Yes.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 5395 or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6pm today. Then join Pearl from 7pm as she starts counting them down. The 95BFM Top 10 with your host, Pearl. Tonight from 7 o'clock and always online at 95bfm.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM, our next piece for today. Now, we all know that anti-establishment sentiment has been an increasingly more relevant and contentious topic around the world, and especially it's something to talk about considering we're going into an election this year. So my producer, Will Parsonson, spoke to Grant Duncan, a professor in politics and public policy, to ask him about the changing landscape of international democracies.
Yes, it's at the moment it's looking all over the place because in some countries, particularly, say, Holland and France, there's been quite a dramatic fragmentation and almost a disappearance of the traditional centre-left, centre-right duopoly parties, you know, a kind of centre-right conservative party and a centre-left Labour or social democratic party basically ruling the political scene in a sort of two-horse race. So in those two countries, that's pretty much been ended, and whereas in the UK and in Germany at the moment, the opinion polls, if they're to be believed, are showing that those two, you know, centre-right, centre-left parties are having a bit of a resurgence. And in the UK, of course, that's getting interesting because they have an election quite soon. Now, if a similar kind of fragmentation, similar to, say, Holland, were to happen in New Zealand, then the equivalent scenario would be a situation where, say, it could get as dramatic as, say, Labour and National combined, you know, barely reaching, say, 50% of the party vote. In the last election, those two parties combined got 72%. But if we were to follow the lead of some of those European countries, that could dramatically decline in the future. I'm not saying that'll happen this coming election, but further down the track, that's the kind of landscape we could see.
Would you say that public opinion is influencing the gap to grow between right-wing and left-wing, or are we moving more central in terms of international politics and international democracy?
Well, the interesting thing about the present national-led government, of course, has been its consistent shuffling towards the left, really. And so that's making it a little bit difficult for the Labour Party to manoeuvre in terms of policy and its sort of ideological position. But yeah, so what's happening is that the four major parties in New Zealand at the moment, Labour, National, New Zealand First and Greens, are all really competing for the centre. There's not really much representation on either the radical left or radical right wings at all. And so it's a crowded centre in New Zealand at the moment. But it does possibly leave a considerable section of New Zealanders feeling as if no political party in Parliament at the moment genuinely represents their values and interests.
Going off that, you're saying that Labour and National are competing with each other for maybe a more central view on things and looking to represent New Zealanders. Would you say that the influence of other countries, dramatic changes within political parties and the potential move to like strong left and strong right, is that affecting New Zealanders' opinions on our own government?
Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? Whether the rise of populist movements and voter revenge, so to speak, in the Brexit referendum and the election of Trump and the overseas are going to have a similar effect on New Zealand. And that was certainly the question that was entertaining my mind since those events last year. The sense I'm getting at the moment, this is just my gut feeling at the moment, is that kind of populist anti-establishment sentiment isn't taking off in a major way in New Zealand at the moment. But, you know, events could prove me wrong, of course, and certainly the politician most able and most well-positioned to take advantage of any kind of populist revolt, of course, is Winston Peters. And, you know, he's doing his usual thing, but I don't really see, in terms of opinion polling, him enjoying any kind of boost at the moment just because of, you know, some kind of long-distance effect of Trump and Brexit are happening in New Zealand. So that doesn't really seem to be happening here at the moment.
That's interesting because we talked to Winston Peters a few months ago and he seemed to think the anti-establishment wave sweeping the globe began with him here in New Zealand first with the Northland by-election. What could you make of this?
Well, that's just, you know, his steering do kind of talk, isn't it? And part of the Winston Peters that we know and love. So, I mean, he's also claiming that the opinion polls, which put him on about 9 or 10%, are way underestimating his real support in the electorate at the moment. But, of course, he won't show us the opinion polls that he's using. And ultimately, we have to wait until the election in 23 September to see how well he really does. But, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, and Nigel Farage from the UK Independence Party, well, the former leader of that party, was boasting about he being the initiator of this so-called global revolution that he was talking about. But UKIP in the UK is really tanking in the opinion polls there now. And similarly in Germany, the alternative for, you know, Germany party, which is the strong anti-immigration, anti-refugee party over there, they're also tanking in the opinion polls there too. So I think that this so-called global revolution actually is looking like a little bit of a scissor at the moment. And I think Winston Peters would probably be unwise to talk it up too much because he may just end up looking a little bit disappointed on election day. So, yeah, although obviously there was a sort of sense that there was this kind of global tide of anti-establishment populist sentiment, I'm just not convinced at the moment that it's really sort of turning into a great tsunami that's going to sweep over New Zealand as well.
So would you say that you wouldn't expect many changes to come of this perceived anti-establishment sentiment? Would you say that things might stay as they are? Or?
Well, pretty much. I mean, you know, looking ahead to the next election, there's no great signs of a shift to, you know, a change of government to a Labour-led government. I'm not saying it can't happen. It can happen, particularly, you know, if you were to get a Labour New Zealand First coalition that, and the Greens were willing to support that arrangement. It's a rather awkward kind of three-party arrangement, but it could happen. That sort of thing has been done before. But the more likely outcome is a national New Zealand First coalition. A lot depends, of course, on how well National actually does and how well its existing support parties do. The Māori Party, for instance, ACT and United Future. So there's a lot of moving parts there, to be honest. It's quite difficult to pick which way it would go. But I guess if you were a betting person, you'd probably say that we would have a national-led government after the next election, just looking at the landscape at the moment. But I don't like to, you know, be too confident making those predictions. But, yeah, sorry, I missed a bit of your question there. Can you run it by me again?
Given these perceptions of anti-establishment, you know, the perceptions that people are having these anti-establishment ideas, what could that mean for New Zealand in the future?
Well, we have had such a sort of voter revolt, and I'm thinking back to 1993 when two interesting things happened. One, we had a vote for the MMP electoral system, and that referendum really can be seen as an anti-establishment kind of voter revolt, I think. And we also, of course, saw the, you know, New Zealand First appear in Parliament with two seats, and the Alliance won two seats as well. So two minor parties got into Parliament, despite the fact that we still had the old FPP system at that election. And they were very much, you know, anti-globalisation, anti-neoliberal type parties. So you could argue that 1993 was our anti-establishment moment in New Zealand, and yes, indeed, we could, you know, one day face another such voter revolt. At the moment, I'm not seeing a lot of evidence that that's actually going to happen in New Zealand. And I mean, I can always be proven wrong, can't I? Because you never know what's going to happen between now and September. But, you know, I don't really sense that there's a great deal of willingness on the part of New Zealanders to really shake up the system. Having said that, of course, you know, there is a lot of cynicism and distrust out there amongst Kiwis. You just have to go online and read, you know, comments, columns to see, you know, what people have to say about parties on both sides of the House. So there's certainly a lot of that kind of anger and distrust around, but I'm not sure whether it's going to translate into a major political or more electoral upset.
That was The Wire.
Yes, you did just hear Bridge whisper, "More freedom, less government" on air. Reading out from that, of course, we have to attribute that to our dear listener. Cheers, Peter. Thank you for your text. Actually, thank you to all of you who texted in. We've got some really great feedback. Somebody said it would be interesting to see just how much per student the government is spending now compared to when they first got into power. So that's in reference to the interview I did with Tracy Martin from New Zealand First, who was talking about the budget announced last week. Yes, listener, I do agree. It'll be interesting to look at that. Maybe that could be some fodder for a wire in the future. But that is the end of our show today. Thank you to everybody who spoke with us. That is Greg Harford, Maxine Gay, Tracy Martin, Alan Blackman, and also Grant Duncan at the end there. Unfortunately, we've run out of time to play our last interview with Thomas Owen, who has travelled over to the Yukon in Canada and is doing some research there, which sounds like a really interesting topic, but I want to play that in full for you all next week, so tune in then. But yes, thank you to my two producers, Adam and Will, and up next is The 1 to 4.